Hey, how you doing? And welcome to the Kate Thompson
Radio.
Live Show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Eric Payne. I am the son, the co-host, and you are?
Kate Thompson, and I am the mother of Eric Payne, actor, director, producer.
Okay. Before my mom adds too many other things that I don't actually do, what we want to say is thanks, everybody, for calling in. And we want to welcome you. We have a caller at 718-655. I believe that might be our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman. And I'm just trying to get so you can come in here, Mr. Wayne. Wayne, go on. Can we hear you? Can you?
Hello.
Go on, Wayne. You're on the air.
Oh, great. And thank you once again. I know I've been missing in action the last couple of weeks. But good to be back.
Yeah, how about that?
It's good to have you there, Mr. Ace Newsman. I know you're out there making news.
Oh, yeah, I tell you. I felt like I was part of the news today. I blocked traffic in Westchester County. I finally gave my Jeep a burial, and I want nothing more to do with it anymore. It's the 21-year relationship has come to an end.
I see. Was it a Jeep Wrangler?
It's a Grand Cherokee I've had for a long time, and I like to fix old things. My mother used to accuse me of doing that all the time. I always fixed old women, old this, old that. So I keep things for a long time, it's a new day now. So I've gone through like an epiphany sitting in the hot blazing sun. it's just time to give it up.
Glad to have you, Wayne. This is you're talking about age now. Listen, watch yourself. I want to get into a serious subject right now that I have a really great problem with. There's this story, that's on the news about the guns that this 9-year-old was being trained in handling guns and shooting and whatnot.
In Arizona,
And the gun went off. I understand it was a Uzi. So, of course, we didn't see when the gun actually went off and shot and killed this guy. But talk about insanity with a young kid, working with a gun. What kind of sense is this? What were the parents thinking of?
The thing is, I agree with you, Kay. That struck me funny this morning when I first heard it, and then I heard it was all over YouTube. And I just can't believe, but society has just gotten to the point now where a lot of people feel that it's necessary to arm themselves. And a few months ago, I had a heated argument, but I was talking to one of my siblings who's in the military, and she's a big advocate of young women, particularly young women, getting trained on how to use a firearm.
Oh, brother.
Mm-hmm.
I know, and that's what I said.
Yeah.
But why is she an advocate? And let me just pose a question to you and my mom, since you both seem to be anti that. Why do you think that's a bad idea?
Well, the thing is, I grew up at a time when, my parents always instilled in me, if I ever got one, I would probably use it or it'd be used against me in the wrong way. To a certain extent, I understand. My sister's been in Iraq, she's been in Afghanistan, and I understand what she was saying about it, and but I don't advocate. I think there's enough violence going on because of the ability, the easy access to guns, and that the fact that across the United States, not every state observes the same, this is the one thing that I would say redeeming about our former mayor here in New York, Michael Bloomberg, is that he was trying to put an end to the gun violence in this town.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the guns that come up from out of the South, Virginia, you go down to Florida, you go to Walmart, you see all these things on display, like as if it's milk and sugar that you would buy at the grocery store, And
right,
it's got to
right.
stop somewhere,
I completely object to this because the fact that it harms people. And to put a military weapon in the hands of a young child, that is sheer insanity. It does not make any sense whatsoever.
I tell you, Kay, what really got me upset is the fact that, the Arizona authorities did not see any criminality involved with this because this guy was instructing her with obviously some parental permission, and it was just a horrific accident, as they put it. And I just said, what is this world coming to?
Well, you know, I mean, I think this subject kind of falls in a couple of different categories. A, what your sister was talking about, I believe, in women learning how to shoot and stuff like that. And I don't know if I haven't had the discussion that you've had with her, but I would see the value in that in terms of women being able to be safe on the streets. I don't know about, you know, obviously she's in common, but I can imagine I'm going to make an assumption that she might have been referring to women being able to protect themselves on the street from criminals and perpetrators and things like that. From the perspective of guns in our society, that seems to be our tradition in America, right? I mean, we went from an agricultural society, a society where people had to hunt for their food, and, you know, out west and the Midwest and South, the gun culture is big out there. I mean, guns are part of are another tool like they use, and I don't have a problem with that, with the proper instruction and the proper guidance. And that, I think, that's where we get into these problems of A, what are the guidelines for allowing kids to shoot? They said that, you know, and all day, obviously, everybody watches the news stories all day, but experts were saying that the recoil, and that's a submachine gun. The Uzi was invented by an Israeli for the Israeli army. And that a young body, a young person, might not be strong enough to hold an automatic submachine gun because of its recoil. And a lot of these kids that get their first gun when they're hunting are usually, you know, a lot of people say, you know, I had a rifle, a bolt action, single 22, single shot, and there's not much recoil there. Certainly, it's only one shot, so it's not going to continue to go off as long as you have your finger pressed on the trigger. So,
well,
I'll
tell you something. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say one last point. Also, to me, I totally agree with the lunacy that it's a kind of a crazy idea to give a child a submachine gun and teach them how to shoot. I mean, obviously the guy thought it was safe. He was supposed to be a gun expert, so I don't know why he wasn't aware of the potential for recall. And, you know, clearly it was an accident.
Recall,
and the prayers go out to her family, but still, it's an accident that could have been provided.
Sure,
and we need to take another look at the lunacy of the gun culture. And you're right about Michael Bloomberg. He was trying to do a good thing and taking some guns out, but I've seen issues on the internet about sheriffs that are against gun control, and some people actually come out and say that, you know. And I also saw a story about, I'm sorry, just one last thing about a group of police officers that have an organization, first responders, ex-officers, military people called the Oath Keepers.
Mm-hmm.
And Oath Keepers are a group that has pledged to uphold the Constitution, but will also pledge to not disobey orders from the federal government or government entities that they deem to be unconstitutional. So I see kind of a larger, broader problem and issue.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it seems like it's going to fall on the side of race, because this Oath Keepers group didn't really pick up their membership and really start to come together until 3 months after President Obama was in office.
Yeah. You know, my problem with the whole thing is the fact that the police departments are becoming and are militarizing. Okay, there's no way in the world that they should have the same kind of, you know, high level of weapons that you have on the battlefield in the police department. You are helping with your communities, but, for instance, in the Michael Brown shooting out there in you know, Ferguson, this is insanity. The policemen murdered this kid. It should not have happened. But yet, why is in the world are these police departments, you know, militarizing themselves? Who are they going to shoot? And you know, the majority of people that they are shooting right now are black people. Okay? So it's just not the case whatsoever.
Well, I tell you, in response to that, the thing that I really find, you know, unfathomable, that no matter how many efforts, particularly here in New York, efforts are made to engage in behavior modification to see if they can siphon out the bad apples before they actually get within the ranks, But, you know, there's always a chance that somebody slips through. And I don't know if that's done in unison across the country. I don't think there's any uniformity when it comes to this whole issue of gun control whatsoever. It depends on the culture of the state. I know you're talking about the militarization. One of your politicians over there in New Jersey, Nia Gill, I don't know what she her position. Forgive me for, because I know of the name. Correct. I don't know her status in the New Jersey legislature, but she was asking the governor to report on the whole military concept within these police ranks, whether it's the state troopers or the local police in Newark and other parts of the state of New Jersey, because she's concerned based on what she saw in Ferguson. And, you know, again, what about the mentality of this young 9-year-old? A couple of years, about a year ago, the guy who invented the Uzi died. And he said before his death, it's written, it's documented, that he regrets the day that he ever invented it. You
wow.
know? So if wow. he was able to come to that realization at 90-some-odd years of age, before his death, and he wanted the world to know, what are we saying to a 9-year-old, you know, who is getting the feel for this activity? And then I also feel, I've always felt that if enough black people join the NRA, you know, that would scare the bejesus out of half these people out here talking about gun control.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
That's
you know?
Along those same lines, I mean, it's interesting that you said that, because I read an article on the Root website today, which is a black blog website, news and information. And a gentleman wrote an article, I forget his name, maybe it was Albert Butler, I believe. And I don't know the date, but the article was talking about the open carry laws in some states, and mm-hmm. said, I think I'm paraphrasing now, the article said open carry for whites means open season on blacks.
Yeah.
And meaning that mm-hmm. the more people that it would be a different perspective when you have black people who exercise the open carry right than you have white people. And he cited the case of the father that was killed in Ohio, Beaver Creek, Ohio, because he bought a toy. I don't know if it was a toy machine gun or whatever, but it was a toy gun, a replica gun. And he was in the store.
Sure, right.
In the mall in Beaver Creek. Not only was he in the mall, he was in the store where he bought the toy.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say this black man, well, I guess they didn't put it in a bag for him, or didn't put it in a box, or maybe he just took it off the shelf or whatever. Some people saw this black man carrying a gun, what they perceived to be a live gun, called the police, and the police come here and end up shooting this guy. And this is in Ohio, which does have mm-hmm. an open carry law.
Mm-hmm.
So not only were his... If he had a real gun, Mr. Butler, this author points out, would he have been? He would have been within his rights, his legal rights as a resident of Ohio, to be able to carry this gun openly, and so they violated his rights there, and then they shoot him, thinking that it's a gun. So, you know, it's the age-old dilemma in America that there are two Americas: one for white people, unfortunately, and one for black people. And
yeah,
you know, we don't like to keep harping on race, but what else are we to harp on when we see it so abundantly time and time again? And who would have thought that here in 2014 we would still be having these conversations? And this is, of course, after the election of a black president. I don't know if the numbers of police shootings of black men have gone up since a black president has been elected. I'd like to
see
some statistics along those lines, if there is some kind of undercurrent of sending a message out.
But also, you know, there's another facet to this, too. If people think, for example, that the police departments are arming themselves, what in the world do you think that the African-American and the Latino community are going to be doing, too? They're going to be, you know, they would be justified in saying it. If you're carrying a gun and you're going to be using on us, we're going to carry a gun and we're going to be using it. Then you have super warfare. Where is this country going? There doesn't seem to be too many people thinking intelligently, you know, from the police department.
I agree, Kay. I mean, that's the chaos. I mean, that's the problem. Too many people are out here armed. And I think the only answer to that is to disarm. you know?
Yeah, of course. That is exactly the answer. You can't go around with police department with some people who are, you know, wannabe warriors or consider that they're going to be warriors and, you know, carry guns and then use it on certain groups of people or use it, period, unjustly.
Well, I'm one for fairness and parity. So I don't know
about
an eye for an eye, but I don't know about disarming. I would just like to have mine just in case, you know. It's like if you end up in an altercation, there's two people there and you're the one person, you'd like to have an extra person there as well. So it's kind of just want parity, you know. If someone else is going to be armed, and then you should be armed as well if you choose to. You know, they say at times when in certain states when people carry, when everybody's able to carry guns, then crime goes down.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, a lot of those people that want to carry guns, they really don't have the wherewithal to understand that there's an added responsibility there when they carry a gun, and they can't just get mad when, you know, say a group of black kids plays their music too loud and tell you no, they're not going to play it, you know. So
yeah, there's another aspect to this too. Think of this little girl, you know, who, you know, in shooting this Uzi, you know, it looked as if the gun was getting ready to, you know, was shifted to it. So you know what happened to this guy. He died. What about her? How in the world is she going to, you know, grow up as in a sane way?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I don't know how
for the parents, you know, to do it.
Yeah, that was not a good parenting choice to allow your 9-year-old to shoot a Uzi. Who knows? Maybe she wanted to try and shoot one, but I don't think that rule is, you know, but there needs to be a rule. There needs to be a rule on, you know, what you're going to allow children to do.
Yeah.
I think that, you know.
By the way, did you know that Bergen County here in New Jersey has a grenade launcher? You know? They don't have the grenades, thankfully. This is according to, you know, an article in the New York Star Ledger. But what exactly are officials going to use it for? Launching T-shirts at a 4-H fair?
You're
now,
kidding.
This is in the today.
So that's your quoting with the writer.
Yeah,
thing.
I'm quoting.
Also, let me just real quick, if anybody likes to call in and get in our discussion that we're having, you can reach us at 323-679-0906. That's 323-679-0906. We encourage you to call in and take part in this discussion on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can access the Kate Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network by going to blogtalkradio.com/Kate Thompson Live.
Yeah.
And you can hear all of the past shows because they are archived there, and you can hear us currently every Wednesday. So getting back to this discussion, it is really a tragedy, and we need to have one uniform. I agree with you, Wayne. I think you might have been alluding to the fact that perhaps there needs to be one uniform law as regards gun control. But once again, we know that is going to be something that's going to be resisted by the various states because of the culture. But, you know, this issue of states' rights always trumps when we try to have one uniform idea that seems like it's a good idea, you know?
Well, I agree with you, Eric. I mean, the thing is, it's just unfortunate that, you know, we call ourselves the United States, and you would think that word united would mean something. But, you know, again, every part of this country has their respective culture, and you go into some parts of the country, and particularly places like Texas, you know, I've only gone there a couple of times, and every time I've gone there, you know, I always worry about the likelihood of just being stopped unnecessarily, you know, for just being black. I remember what happened to that guy Bird a number of years ago and I'm not saying that happens every day. There are a lot of people of color who live there. But, you know, the deal is that whole racial element is still there. And then on the flip side, you know, I was talking to your mom earlier today, and I don't want to sound like Bill Cosby, but, you know, we got to check ourselves on a few things, too. I mean, the deal is that we got to start learning how to live the straight and narrow, that it's so that we're not in a position where we encourage unnecessary incidents like what happens in Staten Island in the Eric Garner case and what happened in Ferguson. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that everybody who's walking the face of the earth isn't worthy of some sort of you know, disciplined if they're caught doing something wrong. You know, I mean, I as much as I hear on the radio, and I'm not saying that I want to be stopped tomorrow, I really try to make an effort not to talk with my cell phone in my hand, but I can't begin to tell you how many times, you know, every time I enter the car, I worry about being stopped because either I have an important call, and worse yet, you know, I even see the cops. It's one thing for them to, you know, say they're going to pull you over because you're texting and you're talking on the phone. But what happens when I see them do that? Why is it okay for them to do the very – aren't they just as vulnerable to creating an accident or causing a problem, you know, by committing the same crime? I mean, there's so many aspects of our culture that needs to be looked at, and I just think it's a problem, you know. I mean – and now in New York, we have this thing of the whole broken window concept of policing. And, you know, again, we're the ones that's usually directed at. And I admit, I applaud, we have a very progressive mayor. You know, he's married to a black woman. He has a biracial child. I think he understands clearly what goes on out here. I think Reverend Sharpton some weeks ago made it pretty salient to him that what happens to the average black person in a stop and frisk situation could easily happen to his son. They don't know. I mean, half the time when that crap goes on, they don't know who's who. You know,
right? And also, I think that's one of the issues. One of the points he raised, De Blasio, he raised that issue about stop and frisk, if I'm not mistaken, that he was concerned about it because he had a black son.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to his credit. But if you could, and I want to ask you about, I want to go back and ask you about some things, but talk about the broken window policy, because I've been hearing about
that
too.
What is
that? What does that say?
Yeah. To me, it's the quality of life issues. You know, they're looking at anything that just seems – out of the ordinary to basically, you know, check a person if they feel that this person is under suspicion. To me, in some instances, that's no different than stop and frisk, you know.
Wait, what's
because
that?
It's a concept that basically the police commissioners come up with. It's not stop and frisk, but I mean it's looking at quality of life issues because it's already been confirmed that if you could tackle the little things that go on, half the time the big things wouldn't occur because it's like their way of putting a check to something before it gets to the point where it's out of control.
Petty crime. I'm assuming they mean broken window. They kind of just coined the phrase that they see a broken window somewhere. It allows them to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
But the deal is my feeling is that we have to be, as a community, we also have to be very vigilant that, you know, we're not going, if we see something that seems to be questionable, that at least it's checked before anything gets out of hand. You know,
right.
I particularly, you know, where I'm here in the Bronx tonight, I live between places, and the deal is that this is a largely a Caribbean but interracial community, and there's a number of brothers out here who have a culture from their respective island. I'm not going to say where, but they feel that what they used to do in the Caribbean in terms of selling food on the street without having a vendor's license and doing things like that is strictly permissible here because they used to do it back home in their country. And the deal is instead of taking the time when you – I understand it's hard out here. A lot of people can't find work. But I don't think that you have a right to impose whatever values from wherever you came from and make it a part of the American scene if we have a body of laws here that everybody has to abide by and you feel, well, you know, I can break it, you know? And I think those are the things – that I find ridiculous, but, you know, at the same time, if we don't stand up and make sure that those laws aren't upheld, you know, that gives the police department fodder to either ignore what goes on until something serious happens. And
also,
and I just think that that's an issue.
Right. I mean, I agree with you there, but also I kind of veer off or have a slight difference of opinion, because even though we need to check ourselves, we need to make sure that everybody is doing the right thing for the community, we also have to understand the circumstances that have brought us to this point, understand the circumstances that have brought young people like a Michael Brown to the point where, fortunately, he was on his way to college, but there are a great many young black men that are of that age that don't see any way out. They don't see a future. And we need to address, there's a larger number of societal issues that we need to address. But at the same time, I agree with you that we certainly have to address the issues within our community in terms of respecting the law, respecting ourselves, and really how we carry ourselves. But that said, even if those young men are breaking the law, even if they might be rambunctious young men, which what Michael Brown did when they tried to show the tape of him kind of threatening and strong-arming the store owner as a way of trying to make him a thug and suggest that he deserved to be shot in the head before they even knew that he did that, you know, there are counterparts that are non-black that might look like the larger majority population that get off with a slap in the wrist, that get told not to do that again. Or if they're walking down the middle of the street and the cop says, get out the street, the kid mouths off, then they might slap the kid up, or if they get in a tussle with the kid, they might let him go, but they certainly don't shoot him. So we need to have, while we're doing those things, we also need to have an equal dispensing of justice and the equal dispensing of respecting of people's rights, and that's what we don't have, obviously, in this country because of the way it was developed and history. But, you know, all of those things need to be addressed. But the most urgent thing is, until they are addressed, that we need to help our young black men be able to survive. Because a friend of mine told me there's what is and there's what ought to be. What ought to be is we should all be treated equally and fairly and have justice in this society. But what is that our kids get picked off as if they're pigeons flying through the air, or as if their lives don't matter. So what we must do, and contingent upon us as a community, is prepare our young people and say, this, as people have been doing for years, when they give their black sons that talk about being around the police or whatever, we have to prepare them, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And until we get to the point where we have a little bit more control.
Let me go in a little different direction here,
I'm in agreement.
Wait a minute. Let's go in a little different direction here. You know, the problem, too, is we have to also have our people come out and learn how to vote. Okay, and change the political setup, the politics, and whatever, wherever you live, because that's extremely important. Now, you know, when the new president came into office, he was slammed with everything under God, I tell you. So, therefore, if we don't vote the proper people in office to, you know, to strengthen our positions, you know, we're not going to be able to get anywhere. Okay? Now, going into another direction also, this is a thing that I just happened to know. I'm going to go into a different direction here. This is about health. I was reading this, and I said, this is absolutely fascinating. Did you know that there are two new robotic devices that can disinfect a room by flooding the room with a special kind of light? And this is something that some inventor has invented. And it's sent from the United States to Liberia to help in the fight against the deadly Ebola virus. And the name of this is TrueD Smart, and it uses a drone of UV light that is lethal to disease. It causes the microbes make a room 99% germ-free. Is this amazing?
Well, I'd love to use that on my tenants. Where'd you get this at? I mean, because I'd like, you know, I mean, it amazes me. And I tell you, the Ebola virus is nothing to laugh about. But,
no, it is.
You know, I'm glad to hear that something's out there to counter it.
You mean, yeah, like the experimental drug that they gave the Americans once they got back here? drug that they had all the time. I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
No,
I
hear
like,
what you're saying, Eric. Yeah.
You know, it's like all of a sudden you guys had the drug the whole time?
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, okay.
Right.
And it just kind of, you know, I'm always suspicious a little bit
sometimes.
Yes,
you have every right to be.
You know, and it's just ironic
that they had an experimental drug they were holding off, didn't want to use it. But when the American workers, and they say, and they also, people also say, you know, they don't have the type of facilities they have over there. But I'm just wondering, you mean you had a, some recourse all this time, and those people were dying, and, you know, life and death, people are willing to try an experimental drug maybe. You know, so
exactly.
I'm like, okay, you know, something like that. But that's a good tool, too. Hopefully, you know, the laser, that'll work, provided that they get it over there, you know, and don't make the people wait another 10, 15 years before they do it. So, I mean, it just kind of, I heard some other people bring up that notion, and it kind of made me think, like, yeah, they had a drug, and these people are looking like they're cured all this time, you know, I mean, wow.
I know. It's frightening.
I'm also very glad that Reverend Al, you know, stepped up to be counted in the Eric Gardner, you know, killing.
Oh, yeah.
Murder by the police department, okay?
Okay, getting back to
Yeah, getting
to that.
Back
okay.
to, you know, the police department, you know, rushing to something or other. I don't know. This has to stop. There's no doubt about the fact that it has to stop. So.
Right. He had a huge turnout in Staten Island last weekend, and it was very orderly, very disciplined, no violence, and it was multicultural. You know, all sorts of people showed up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did they march? Now, I was not sure, and I didn't keep up with the news to know whether or not they marched across the Staten Island Bridge. Or are you aware of whether they did or not?
No, they took buses across the Verrazano, and what they did, once they got into the borough itself, they disembarked the buses, and they started marching towards the site of where the chokehold incident occurred. And I think they went downtown Staten Island to the borough presidents, the government offices there, to send a message to the Staten Island district attorney and all that. But it was orderly. I mean, it wasn't a situation like Ferguson, and that gives rise to speculation as to why was that so disorderly, and yet we had a throng of people out in Staten Island, and everybody protested, you know, in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King, but there was no incident to speak of. The police were around. You know, everything was held in check. They got their points across. The media covered everybody. There was no problem. And and I even heard Reverend Sharpton refer to some of the people who were looting and acting crazy in Ferguson as thugs. So
in every community, not just in our community, there's always going to be people who take advantage of situations like that. I mean, you know, that's
right.
Par for the course. It's not just black people; it's anybody. So, what happens is, I think in New York, in particular in Staten Island, what happened is that, you know, you have a city government that is not. Has a different perspective. They're more open. They're more, you know, they don't take the guy that wasn't going to take the mayor of New York wasn't going to take the same attitude as obviously the mayor and the governor and whoever else in Ferguson, who seemed to have, you know, when they came out with their military garb, that's more antagonistic of a peaceful march. So, you know, you're not going to have the kind of antagonistic feeling. And that, quite honestly, I don't believe that something to that extent would happen in the East Coast, New York, New Jersey area. So,
well, I mean, what is it with us? I mean, I know that there's a notion that we're very sophisticated on the East, but I'd like to think the same quality of people reside in the West, in the Midwest, and in the South, and all those places too. I mean,
I wasn't talking about us being sophisticated. I'm just talking about A, the masses of people, just sheer numbers, and B, that we live in sometimes a more liberal environment, obviously, in the Northeast.
Yeah,
as opposed
right.
to going out to the Midwest. And my mother brought up a very good point, was that the fact that also, too, the black folk on the ground in Ferguson got to get busy. You got to vote. And they had a couple of elections, not just in Ferguson, but in other communities out there, where they don't come out to vote. And they talked about the percentage of people of color that are on a police force. One had 3%, one had no percent. And these were towns with majority African-American population. So you kind of get what you pay for. So to put it a certain way, if you don't get out there, said only 12% of the black population or something like that even voted in the last election in Ferguson. So, like I said before, when you don't come out and vote and exercise your rights as a citizen, you know, you got a certain amount of responsibility to other people and yourself in your community. You don't exercise those rights, that has a tendency to happen. And clearly, the mayor, the city council, and all those other people in Ferguson, the police director, they had a vested interest in maintaining that power, kind of like I said before, and I'll say it again, kind of like an apartheid South Africa structure.
That's right.
Where the minority was controlling the majority. And even to the point where I think that the police captain or the chief of police there in Ferguson could not be trusted to thoroughly investigate the case. Clearly, the prosecutor cannot be trusted to thoroughly prosecute this case.
The grand jury isn't going to be
helpful. And the grand jury is going to do what they're going to do. So, and we also know that sometimes people on the other side or people in the other group, while they don't express their racism and their prejudice, they keep it to themselves until they get in positions like that where they can affect it, put that racism into effect, put that prejudice into practice. So I think they lay low until they get those opportunities, and then their true colors come out. And so the folks out there in Ferguson need to get involved. They need to get out there and vote, you know.
Not only in Ferguson, but around the country.
No, I'm in agreement. I feel the same way. I think that's what's lacking. And as you mentioned that, I'm reminded of my seventh grade teacher, Sister Mary Flowerpot. I forgot her name, but she always said, Wayne,
Mary,
if it's not in writing, then it's rotten, you know? And I believe the same way when it comes to voting. You know,
Wayne,
if you don't write down and take a stand, it's rotten.
Wayne, did you say Sister Mary Flowerpot?
Yes, I did. I forgot her name. I mean, I'm 60. That happened more than 40 years ago. I know I was in the seventh grade because she always scolded me about, you know, not bringing something in writing, and that's how I remembered that, you know. But it was the Catholic school system I attended back in the day when Bed-Stuy was not gentrified.
Oh, that's before it became Stuyvesant Heights, in other words.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. Well, let me just remind people that we're on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can find the Kay Thompson Live Show with me, Eric Painter, co-host, and Mr. Wayne Gilman, the legendary newsman and co-host, on the Blog Talk Radio Network, blogtalkradio.com/KayThompsonLive. And that's where you will be taken directly to our page,
and where you can hear
archived shows as well as our current show.
And also mention your show. That's, extremely interesting and very revealing, and that is Real Talk.
Oh, yeah. As I started about 2 weeks ago about that. But I'll be talking to folks later on about that, because I'm going to have a show of my own on Blog Talk that I'm going to be doing. So I'll be talking about that at future dates and let people know.
And also, Wayne, we're going to be doing more with education, you know, with educational programs for not only children, but also for senior citizens, all kinds of different things going on that senior citizens can take advantage of. As a matter of fact, there's so many different programs here in New Jersey that it's absolutely amazing, because there is a large senior citizen, group of people, of course. And we really have to include the seniors, and we have to include teachers, because there's a new tool that they're saying that teachers have. In other words, I don't even know why they're calling this new, but the new technique, I'll say, is that it's empowering the students, as one teacher, to be very student-centered, because they are now, you know, talking to students and involving them in conversations, in discussions.
Yeah.
They're proving that classroom discussion engages students. Well, duh, I have been doing that for 40 years.
Yeah, and for the
but
article.
But you'd be surprised, Kay. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't get it. And then, of course, you know, the school system has changed from the time that, you know, even when you were teaching, and
yeah.
I tried my hand at it, and I don't have the patience, you know. I mean, I'm ashamed to say that because I like young people, but I find some of them challenging.
In other words, the little kids got the best of you.
Yeah, they did, you know. You know, why is your hair, Mr. Wayne, so gray? And, you know, it's like you always have to prove a point with them in order to get their attention. And once they realize that you're just as human as they are, then some of them are willing to give you a break. But, you know, it's just a different day. I mean, there was a time when, you know, corporal punishment was in, particularly the grammar school, the Catholic school I was just alluding to earlier about. You know, the bottom line is that, you know, you did something wrong, you would feel it, and then you get home and you feel it again. Today we don't have that, and it's very difficult for a teacher to turn around and discipline someone because right away the kids have more rights than we do. And
right.
And I happen to think to a certain extent, you know, it's a good thing for senior citizens to also go back and understand how the world is changing because there's so many of us who are not in lockstep with all the changes that go on. You know?
Right.
So I think that's very important.
In the world that we're in now, and I was discussing this with my mom earlier, in the world that we're in now, particularly with the advent of the internet and on-demand things, there are things out there that really you can cover every interest that someone might have.
Yeah.
And our society, unfortunately, has a tendency or had a tendency to kind of push the youth. And when you get to a certain age, you know, you're expected or you're pushed into or you're put into a certain category. And nowadays, that does not have to be the case because what happens is that you have a very or you're able to reach the audience that you want to speak to. There's a lot of information, not just for seniors and stuff like that, but also just in terms of their generation. I know my generation, I'm sure you too, Wayne. When I reminisce or talk about things that went on during the course of my life or things that I remember, you know, there's a certain appreciation that people my age group might have for those things and might remember.
Right.
And as I remember things coming up that were part of my mother's generation, when I, in particular, one example that comes to mind, you know, we used to see those old cartoons, those old Looney Tune cartoons, and they might throw in a caricature, a cartoon character based on Frank Sinatra or somebody like that, that was a person that was popular of that cartoon maker's generation. But we got exposed to who those people are, and then as we grew up, we understood what those little caricatures or who they were referring to. And there's a certain parts of my life that I always like to remember. I like to remember the fact about the Rat Pack and that this guy Frank Sinatra hung out with this black guy, Sammy Davis Jr. So as a kid coming up in my life when I would watch all these shows and these movies and see mostly, you know, white people being depicted or white stories being told, there would be this one story that always included a black guy. So when I thought about Frank Sinatra, I was going to watch Frank Sinatra movies because it kind of told me, subliminally, I guess, as a kid, that someone that looked like me was welcome in his sphere of people, of influence. So, So stuff like that is really important. And it's important to remember that people like that exist, especially now that we have this 24-hour news culture, very short attention span. You know, and these people are becoming famous and popular overnight for no other reason than being just that, no talent, nothing. So, I mean, we need to remember those things, remember those things of the past and make sure. And nowadays, you know, people could go online and type in, I want to see all old black and white movies, and you get all old black and white movies. So now we want to talk to some of those people that are of my mother's generation and those people that are in yours and my generation, but particularly let them know. You know, it's not a thing where we're putting people out to pasture. Nobody's out. It's a different society now.
Yeah.
So everybody can be
active.
Well,
I'm glad you brought that up, not to cut you off, Eric, because I tell you, you know, one thing that always fascinated me, and I when I say fascination, I it's just out of curiosity. When Frank Sinatra was at his peak, or even as he was in his twilight of his years, you know, he would give a concert at Radio City Music Hall or Madison Square Garden or, you know, at some big emporium out in Jersey. And those people of all generations, particularly people of his ethnic background and other whites, you know, would come out and show their support and appreciation for him. I mean, even if he couldn't hit the notes the way he used to, he would do that. But if it came to someone, you know, like James Brown or Ronnie Isley or, you know, somebody who even Smokey Robinson who is really our Frank Sinatra of our generation, or at least I would speak of mine, you know, because I'm a little older than you are, Eric. I mean, you know,
and
rarely do you see the kind of support. I'm sorry, Kay?
Yes.
No, I heard you say something.
Go ahead, Wayne.
No. But the thing is, I never see the support coming from our community. It's almost as if we're for the minute. If there's something fascinating, or if it's a novelty, or you know, even rap music. I mean, there will be people lined up right around Radio City Music Hall, 10 times triple deep, you know, and come out to see Nas or somebody like that. But, you know, if it had been Smokey Robinson, Aretha Franklin, or, you know, somebody who is of an earlier generation, or, you know, but made their mark, I don't think they get the same reverence and respect from young people as whites would have come out for Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley when he was alive. I mean, I know what I speak of because I've watched it too many times, and I often question, you know, people in the music industry back then, why is this disparity? What is it with us? And it's not about buying a ticket, because I know some people, there's been documented evidence that most minority families spend more money on entertainment when it comes to cable television and things like that than the average white person. So there you go. Why is it that we don't
show you're saying that the black people wouldn't come out to support Smokey like they would I don't know. I mean, if I had a chance to go see
it.
You've seen it.
Yeah.
You're not from Jersey.
You said you've seen it?
I said you're not
from
Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it right here in New York. I mean, I've never seen – I mean, Smokey is a popular ticket, but I tell you, when you juxtapose the kind of drawing power that Frank Sinatra once had compared to a Smokey Robinson, who I think is – really one of the unsung poets of our generation. There will never be another Smokey Robinson again, you know,
true.
At least not of this time. And the thing is that this man has done, you know, he's done so many genres of music. He's even done rap. There's something on YouTube that I periodically go back to. I can't think of the name of the cut, but he comments about Black America and the word nigger and stuff like that. And, I mean, Smokey, he's in his mid-70s now, or maybe early 70s. And I just think that it saddens me. You know, maybe it's a New York thing. I don't know. Maybe in other parts of the country he'll pack a house. But, you know, the bottom line is that, and it's not just him. It's other people of that generation who've made their mark. I don't see the reverence and respect coming from our folk in great numbers as opposed to what I see in the other community.
I don't know. I mean, I'll have to, yeah. Because I maybe in New York, but I think that if you get to places like down south or the Midwest, when Smokey comes through there, I think that he's probably going to be sold out for the people. I noticed in when I was living in Los Angeles, and I think also there's a similarity in New York, maybe Chicago, but there's so much to do in these bigger city hubs that, and I agree with you that Frank Sinatra probably would have gotten sold out in New York regardless, but there's so much to do in these larger entertainment centers, Los Angeles and New York, that sometimes, you know, people don't always pack the houses or do things like that. So, but I think that black people would come out and support him to a certain degree. It's just that age group that he appeals to, that he still appeals to, has gotten older and maybe not gone out as much. And also, too, you got to remember, once hip-hop came on the scene, that seemed to be the only type of music
that the established music industry was trying to push, and then once they got it to be more negative, clearly they began to push that even more.
Remember James Brown. James Brown would pack any place. The Godfather of Soul.
Sorry, I was just going to say that as a kid, I used to go from Brooklyn, sneak out the house, because my mother used to give me hell for even playing James Brown in the house. You know, if it wasn't 24 hours, 7 days a week of soca, something I didn't quite understand until I became an adult, you know, if I was caught playing James Brown, you know, the belt would be nearby, and that was it. I remember the first time I went to the Apollo Theater. I stood in line with some friends of mine from Brooklyn and, you know, and stood in the cold just to get in there to see James Brown. But that was the deal. I mean, I just don't feel the same energy, or maybe I'm old now and I don't, you know, I'm not really, really analyzing this properly, and perhaps it might be the whole venue aspect, as you pointed out, Eric. Maybe it's because there's so many different things in New York that can distract. But, you know, I just remember droves of people when this man was alive, Frank Sinatra. They would come out, and largely people of all generations, old, young, you know, middle class, poor, rich, you know. It's like he could walk on water even when he couldn't sing anymore, you know, because he was Frank Sinatra.
He was a legend. And also, you got to remember, Frank also embraced at that time a lot of black artists. He was a jazz singer.
Yeah.
And he wasn't, and I'm just going by a guy who was young at the time, but looking at it, he seemed not to be afraid to let people know or to express that he was cool with black people and that he was not a racial dude. You know what I mean? So I think that helped his crossover appeal, particularly with African-Americans who knew that they could go see Frank Sinatra. He had the silver voice, the velvety voice back in the day. And he was, you know, he was accepting of all people. And I think that helped him a lot. I'm a guy who was, you know, old enough to be his son or his grandson. And he had a certain appeal to me because of the way he carried himself, primarily because of his movies. And also he had such a East Coast, he's a Jersey guy, so you kind of relate that out from that perspective as well, you know, because I watch, you know, when we had the 4:30 movie back here. If anybody's from the East Coast, you know, during the 60s and 70s, we had the 4:30 movie. This is before cable. It used to come on ABC Network, and every day when we used to get home after school, after junior high, do your homework, and you could watch the 4:30 movie, which would stay on until about 5:30 or 6 o'clock when the evening news would come on. And you would that's where we got to see all those Elvis movies, Frank Sinatra movies, John Wayne movies, all of the movies that were out when we were kids at the time.
Well, what's your standing about Michael Jackson?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I felt a certain emotional attachment to Michael because, you know, well, Kay, you were there in the studio when he would come by, you know, with Frankie and you know, buy coffee for us, and the deal is to see him become larger than life. I'll never forget the day, you know, when I heard the announcement that he had died. I was actually in Jersey at Rutgers University. And I couldn't believe, you know, when one of the teachers had told me what had happened. I had taken the train over. By the time I got out the tunnel into the school, I was just shocked to hear that he had passed. And I don't know what happened to Michael. I mean, I remember seeing him later in life with Sharpton. I was asked by the old general manager at the station to attend a meeting. There was this conflict between Tommy Mottola and Michael over some music. I forgot exactly the nature of the story. Again, it's going back maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but it was long before he had passed. And when I saw what looked to me as a younger person, a very attractive young black kid, turn around and disfigure himself, you know, just to identify, I'm assuming, with another nationality or something that he was attracted to, that he had to turn and become so disfigured, I just said to myself, well, what went wrong? You know, here's this guy who's larger than life, could have anything that he ever wanted, And, you know, it's like even the Robin Williams killing. I mean, I you know, talk about somebody, regardless of what, regardless of what nationality. I mean, he identified with everyone. I just thought this guy was amazingly brilliant. But what is it that when people get in the depths of whatever it is that they're going through, that they, you know, that they're willing to, you know, sacrifice all this talent and life? It's just truly sad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And,
In reference to,
I don't know the answer to that one.
In reference to Michael, you know, it is a fact. Let's stay for the facts that he did suffer from vitiligo, which was the disease that caused his skin to lighten. In terms of the plastic surgery about his nose and all that, who knows? Once they say people start, and that might have been his attempt to change his looks. You know, they say that he had such an estranged relationship with his father that I believe, and I don't know if it's from, if I got this notion from speaking to someone else, but that he didn't want to look like Joseph Jackson, so he did whatever he needed to do to change how he physically looked. And then obviously it's a fact that he hated the size of his nose, which, you know, really wasn't a
Eric, if you met the kid that we met back then, you know, and
I want you to talk about that. I want to touch on, but we got about 4 minutes left to the show, and you have a Michael Jackson story when he came through the radio station. So talk about that, because that's something that's interesting to me and other people that might be listening as well.
Well, I mean, we're going back into time, but I mean, the deal is that there was a time when Frankie Crocker, the Pied Piper of black radio, and basically someone who basically set the trend for black urban music in this area and across the country before that format became ever popular. He was the one, the architect, the blueprint. He would bring in a lot of the formidable black acts of that particular genre to a certain level of prominence because of the success of what he was doing with WBLS. I'm talking about the late 1970s, the early 80s, the whole disco era, you know, the fighting back and forth between the white stations and the black stations, and then he even lived long enough to see the destruction of the black music departments in a lot of these record companies, because all of a sudden Michael Jackson became pop. And there was a time when it was still a whole racial thing in terms of playing his music. Even on MTV, as late as 1988 or 89, I could be wrong as far as the dates. But, you know, the deal is that he was able to break through all that, transcend all that, but because I was lucky enough, and your mother included, to work around Frankie, you know, for so many years, we had a chance to meet a lot of people who ordinarily, I mean, I can speak for myself, your mom was already in the business long before I even started, so
I don't mean that as
disrespect, but the deal is, it's just that I was fascinated when I started meeting people who basically I would read about, hear about, you know, even DJs that I never thought I would work with, you know, that I found myself working with, Murray Decay and Rocky G and people like that of that generation. And when you look back at that and see where we've come from back then and see where we are now, you know, this is what we did gave birth to what's happening today. I used to hear the old guys talk about what they did giving birth to giving me an opportunity to do what I did. And I was blessed, you know, I used to get my behind kicked a few times, but I was blessed to finally get my act together and know that if I had to work with people like your mom and other people, I had to get my game in order, you know.
Okay. I want to put a pin in it right there, Wayne, because we about a minute left before we have to end the show. But I do, next week, want to interview you and my mother about those days at WLIB-BLS, because those are historic days here on the East Coast and in the New York, New Jersey area. And really, that was a historic time, and I really want the listeners to understand that. But we're going to have to sign off now. We want everybody to call us and come go to blogtalkradio.com/KTompsonLive. We'll take you right to our page. You can listen to tonight's show
as many times as you like, or you can listen to other shows that we've done. Today is, I believe, August 27th on the Kay Thompson Live Show. Next week we'll be back again next Wednesday at 8 o'clock, 8 to 9 p.m., and I'm going to be talking to the legendary loose man, Wayne Gilman, my mom, Kay Thompson, about that time. So, signing off for the Kay Thompson Live Show, my name is Eric Payne. You are Wayne Gilman, right?
That's right, all my life.
And I'm Kay Thompson.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Hit us back again next week on the Kay Thompson Live Show here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio.